From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For 3 years, the film director Henry Jaglom recorded his lunch conversations with Orson Welles. But for years, they just sat there, the tapes, gathering dust in Jaglom's garage. When the film historian Peter Biskind heard about them, he thought of them like a treasure lost in an attic, and so he asked if he could transcribe the tapes and show them to the world. Biskind's book, My Lunches with Orson, has become popular with a lot of people because of the outrageous part of Welles' character, his petulance, his tawdry gossip. And yes, he could be vulgar and petty at times, but for Biskind, the tapes made him fall in love with his mind. He could be brilliant, Welles could, when talking about politics and music and literature. Today in the program, Peter Biskind will join us to talk about these lunch conversations and how they may or may not reveal the true Orson Welles. After the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Some of you may remember what kind of a conversationalist Orson Welles could be if you saw him on Carson or on Cavett. He was funny and elegant and often provocative, and that was in public. Now imagine what he could be like in private, like, say, at lunch. Well, for 5 years, the director and actor Henry Jaglom had lunch with Orson Welles, and for 3 of those years, he brought a tape recorder along with him. The tapes remained in an old shoebox in a garage collecting dust until the film historian Peter Biskind learned about them. With Jaglom's permission, Biskind had the tapes transcribed, and he edited them into a book called My Lunches with Orson. Biskind says the conversations give us a peek into the struggles that overshadowed Welles' life in his last years, his financial issues, his inability to get projects started or finished. But mostly they reveal an incredible mind. Peter Biskind is joining us today to talk about the book. Again, it's called My Lunches with Orson, Conversations Between Henry Jaglom and Orson Welles. You can join us if you like, if you have comments or reflections or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Peter Biskind is a film historian and a contributing editor to Vanity Fair. He edited My Lunches with Orson, and he's joining us today from member station WAMC in Albany, New York. And Peter Biskind, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, I wanted to start with, I guess, to get a sense of, it seems like in some way there's this the mythic part of Orson Welles, the kind of petulant, elegant, provocative guy, and then there's the other part of him, a more shy type that you talk about in the book a little bit too. I wanted to start there. What is your sense of the way most people think of Orson Welles? Because it seems hard to get at who the real guy was.
Well, it's impossible to get at who the real guy was. In fact, you know, I sort of raised my eyebrows when you said a shy side. If I mentioned a shy side, I can't remember it. I mean, he was a blustery, bigger-than-life figure, as you've mentioned. Everything about him was bigger than life. Physically, he was bigger than life. You know, at that point in time, he weighed approximately 300 pounds.
Yeah.
I said he was about the size of a baby elephant.
Yeah.
And I actually looked up baby elephants, and indeed they weigh about 300 pounds, I guess, with some variation from baby to baby. But, you know, and he was biting. He had a biting wit. He was very, very funny. The thing, I guess, that impressed me most reading over the transcripts was how smart he was and how much he knew about a wide variety of subjects. You know, I expected somebody, you know, who knew a lot about movies because that's what he devoted, you know, 2/3 of his life to. Mm. But he was very political. He came of age in the 20s and 30s, which, as you probably all know, was during the Depression, which was a very politicized era in American life. He was a lefty, as most people were in those days. He was never a member of the Communist Party. In fact, he was an anti-Stalinist.
Yeah.
But he did, you know, share a lot of, he supported Franklin Roosevelt. He knew Roosevelt well. And he supported a lot of New Deal. You know, I guess you'd call him a New Dealer.
Yeah.
But in any event, I was very impressed with, he knew a lot about, he had apparently done some sort of newsletter for the French Resistance, so he knew a lot about the resistance in France and had a lot of opinions about the politics of World War II. So that's actually what impressed me most was his breadth of knowledge, as in his intelligence, and also his originality of mind. You know, he would say the nuttiest things, and when you challenged him, he would never back down, but he would come up with justifications, rationalizations that were wholly original and more interesting than the things that he had said initially.
Right. Well, let's talk about a few of those, because I mean, this is the stuff that's revealed in these conversations, and we'll talk about how we came about with these conversations in a moment. But this idea, these kind of outrageous theories that he would have, and it's great because Henry Jagiellon will challenge him on these things. But as you say, he sticks to his guns. He has one theory, for example, on short people, short directors, short dictators. You want to say something about that?
Well, yes, he says all dictators are short, essentially, you know, and then he, you know, which is one of those kind of generalizations. You go, But then he actually lists, you know, I don't know, six or seven dictators, starting, of course, with Napoleon, but going through, you know, many of the others, including Stalin. And he, of course, was, Wells himself was about 6'2", and he says you never see any tall dictators, and you start thinking about that, and that seems to be the case. You know, so things that seem absurd on the face of it, you know, after he gets finished convincing you, you sound plausible.
Yeah.
I mean, among other things, he was a great believer in ethnic differences, which were, you know, after World War II were, under a cloud because of the Nazis and their practices of eugenics. And even in the 70s and 80s, when these conversations took place, people who would say things like, Jews have certain characteristics, or black people have certain characteristics, or Poles have certain characteristics, it was frowned upon and treated, you know, as extremely politically incorrect. So Jagiellon challenges him on some of this when he starts talking about how he dislikes certain actors because of the way they look.
Right.
And then he says, you know, Jagiellon says, well, how can you dislike, have you ever met Woody Allen? Because he's short. Have you ever met him? And Wells says, no, but I don't like, you know, short actors. Or right. Marlon Brando's neck looks like an old shoe. And so Jagiellon raised his eyebrows, presumably, and started saying, you know, what are you talking about? And then Wells goes on this, you know, tirade about ethnic characteristics. For example, he says, I don't know, Sardinians or Bosnians have short, stubby fingers, and another ethnic group has large chins and so forth and so on. And he argues it and argues it. He never stops and says, no, maybe I'm exaggerating or maybe I'm wrong. You know, he just goes with it.
This is the revealing part, I think, in some ways of him, that he could be so lucid in making these arguments. And I think in some way you never really know if he's entirely serious, if there's some kind of irony there, or if he just sort of found himself trapped and that he had to find his way out. But the brilliance of the way he finds his way out says a lot about Orson Welles. I mean, these conversations are really revealing. Whether he's performing or not, you get a sense of who the man was.
Well, he was a real provocateur. He loved to provoke people, and yeah. He provokes Jagiellon constantly. You know, he goes into this whole thing about how he hates the Irish.
Right.
You know, and Jagiellon, confronts him on it. And Wells, of course, doesn't back down, but he starts in about how the Irish, who lived under, you know, oppressive poverty and under the British heel of the British for so long, have learned to be crafty and malicious. You know, if there's one word that characterizes the Irish, he says it's malice. So then he goes on to say he has no problem with the Irish in Ireland, but it's the Irish, it's the Irish diaspora, you know, the American Irish, or the, you know, I think he also says the he doesn't mind the British Irish, but certain kinds of Irish, he can't. This has to do with Spencer Tracy, because he's traducing Spencer Tracy and what a bad actor he is, how egotistical he was, so forth. And Jagum, of course, comes out with, well, what about Robert Ryan? He was an exemplary person, a liberal and so forth. And Wells said, well, he wasn't Irish. You know, that's you know, Robert Ryan, you know, Jagum says, well, Robert Ryan is an Irish name. Wells has some cockamamie reason why it isn't, or it doesn't apply to Ryan, and it goes on and on and on.
Well, the argument, it's interesting, and this is the title of this particular chapter, and he says this to Jagum. He says everybody should be bigoted.
Well, I think he means that everybody should admit their bigotry.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is not unreasonable.
Right.
You know, he's got a point.
Well,
I mean, there's always a point or a kernel in everything, in almost everything he says, no matter how nutty.
It's interesting.
And a lot of the things he says, I don't mean to give the impression that everything he said was nutty. It wasn't. A lot of it was very shrewd and insightful.
Yeah. I liked how also, you know, Wells was a progressive guy politically, ideologically. But he really likes the right-wingers. In fact, in some ways, he says, I like the righties more than the lefties. They seemed more enjoyable to him in some way. He didn't like the idea of piety that he got from the left.
No, he didn't. And you know, Jagum says, you know, he's going on and on about the Irish, and Jagum says, well, what about John Ford? You like John Ford. And Wells says, of course I like John Ford, and I like John Wayne, and I liked Ward Bond and that whole Ford circle. And he says John Wayne was extremely polite, always very cordial to him and polite and behaved correctly. And he does say, yes, that he liked the right-wingers better than the left-wingers. Not all of them, though. I mean, you know, he talks about Adolf Menjou and what a jerk he was.
Right.
But this group around John Ford, he was quite fond of.
I want to back up a little bit and lay out some context for these conversations. Let's talk a little bit about Orson Welles and your sense of the man. I wanted to ask you how you assess his, I'll use the word gift, I guess, because you write about Citizen Kane, of course, which is thought of by many people as the greatest film ever, certainly one of them anyway. What was the thing that he was so good at? Because you write about how, at least in that film, and maybe even this, you can apply this more broadly to his life, that he had a kind of wizardry with time and space and light and this being able to deal with the tensions of this, as you call, his furious operatic imagination, and yet this sense of focus. Do you think you have an understanding about what it was that he was so particularly good at?
Well, if you're asking me, you know, sort of what was the essence of his gift, you know, it's really hard to say because he was so gifted in so many ways. I mean, you know, Citizen Kane is a wonderful, on the story level, it's a wonderful story. But at the same time, it's extremely stylistically and aesthetically innovative. I mean, you know, giving you things that you never saw in the movies at that time and still don't see very much. You know, I mean, not only it's famous for its deep focus photography, and to some degree he owes that to his cinematographer, Greg Toland. But, you know, all the transitions from, you know, he didn't just use the usual wipes and dissolves, all the transitions from scene to scene. Plus, he did very daring juxtapositions of different times and different angles. I mean, it's sort of breathtaking. And the style of the film is always in your face. I mean, and it's all, you're always aware that you're watching a movie. In some sense, it's very Brechtian. And he was, I guess, one of the things that he was so adept at, he was a great innovator.
Yeah.
So that when he did Shakespeare in the theater, which he did early on when he was still in his 20s, before he started directing movies, he was always giving it a twist. You know, he did a black Macbeth, and he did a Julius Caesar that he set in contemporary fascist Italy. You know, he was always thinking how do I do this differently? How do I bring this to life? How do I make it relevant to what's going on today? Part of that was informed by his enormous, you know, awareness of his interest in politics,
yeah.
and which you could not ignore, obviously, in the 30s during the Depression and then throughout World War II.
You make references to a remarkable story in his early life. He was 16 years old. His mother died at an early age, so his guardian becomes Dr. Maurice Bernstein, and he somehow convinces this man, his guardian, to let him, at 16 years old, mind you, travel to Europe alone, to Ireland, and to go on this walking tour.
Yes, and also the other part of that story, which is fascinating, is to avoid Harvard, which he got a scholarship to at the age of 16. He didn't want to go to college. He especially didn't want to go to Harvard. So he talked Dr. Bernstein into letting him go on a walking tour of Ireland. And in the course of which, he stumbled across the Gate Theater in Dublin mm-hmm. and talked his way, convinced him that he was an actor of note, an up-and-coming actor of note in America, and convinced them to give him a role in several plays, and met all those people, which he remained friendly with and used in his own work later on.
Yeah.
He had a golden tongue.
I mean,
you know, he could talk himself into, you know, he could talk anyone into anything.
Yeah. He becomes sort of a boy wonder in the New York theater scene at this incredibly young age, founded the Mercury Theater in 1937. 3 days after his 23rd birthday, you say, he was on the cover of Time magazine. This was in 1938. There's, of course, War of the Worlds, which became spectacular. And then comes Citizen Kane. And often you hear about how Wells' life didn't match the expectations of the work that he was doing in his 20s as a young man. Was this something that did you get a sense of that when you look at the conversations? That he sort of realized that? I mean, what did he make of this idea that he hadn't lived up to the expectation?
Well, absolutely, he makes jokes about it.
Yeah.
You know, he says, I should have quit after Citizen Kane.
Right.
You know, I mean, while you were talking, I was thinking, we have nobody today who you can compare him to in the terms of his early success and the way he just kind of, exploded. Mm. Across different, I guess today we call them platforms, but in those days, through the theater, movies, radio, I mean, you look at somebody like, Girls, you know, what's her name?
Oh, yeah, Lena Dunham.
Lena Dunham,
yeah.
Who's been enormously successful, made a couple of movies, has her show Girls, and yet it's nothing like Wells,
yeah.
You know, and for him to carry that forward into the, you know, and throughout a long career, I mean, for anybody to do that, I think is almost impossible. I mean, you really have to search for examples of people who have done that. After Citizen Kane, you know, he just encountered a bizarre combination of bad luck and self-inflicted wounds,
yeah.
and all sorts of things that conspired to prevent him, I think, from realizing. He'd already realized his potential, so you can't say that. And I guess, you know, there are a lot of movie directors whose reputations are based on one movie.
Right.
And in a way, you know, he could rest on Citizen Kane. It is one of the best movies of all time. And, you know, if I had made Citizen Kane, I'd never, you know, have to do, if anybody had made Citizen Kane, they'd never have to do anything else.
It's true.
But nevertheless, I mean, it did sort of certainly created expectations that he would go on and make other brilliant movies, if not as brilliant as Citizen Kane, nevertheless, respectable ones. And he did make some very, very good movies subsequently.
Of course.
But as I said, there was, you know, almost a perfect storm of bad news after Citizen Kane, starting with World War II, the outbreak of World War II, while he was shooting his next movie, The Magnificent Ambersons,
yeah.
and then his being posted to Brazil by President Roosevelt and being unable to finish the movie, and that was the beginning of it.
Yeah. Well, that, of course, they banded it, cutting it for him. It was terrible. He hated it. And in some ways, he never really recovered. I think that's what you say in the book. He never really recovered from that experience.
He didn't. I mean, he had several opportunities. I mean, he did make a few other features, you know, and there, some of them are very highly regarded. Lady from Shanghai, Touch of Evil, several films about Shakespeare, several play Macbeth and right. Othello, and a film called Chimes at Midnight, which is a kind of amalgam based on Falstaff. And he, the last feature film that he made was a what he called an essay film, which was a kind of half-fiction, half-documentary meditation on fakery and authenticity in art.
Yeah.
It was came out a bit after this Clifford Irving had written his faux biography of Howard Hughes, and the film focuses on Irving and also on a very well-known art forger. It's a fascinating movie. Did no business, got dumped by the distributor, and, you know, was one of the great disappointments of Welles' career, because he felt that had F for Fake, which was the name of it, done well, he could have gone on to make a lot of films like that, and those films were very inexpensive to make.
Let's talk about Henry Jaglom a little bit, because he starts off as an actor, eventually turns to writing and directing, and he comes to be somewhat influential in the business, and he has this abiding respect for Orson Welles. And I guess it's fair to say he becomes Welles' biggest supporter, kind of looks after him professionally.
Well, that's true. I mean, Jaglom came to Hollywood in around 1965 at the beginning of what came to be known as the New Hollywood. Or, you know, the director's decade, when directors essentially became the most powerful people in the movie business. It didn't last too long, but it was wonderful while it happened. And he hooked up with a bunch of people that orbited around a small company called BBS, including a couple of actors like Jack Nicholson, who became a friend of his. BBS made The Last Picture Show, Easy Rider, and Five Easy Pieces, which drove the New Hollywood at the very beginning. And Jaglom talked Bert Schneider, who was the principal of BBS, into financing his first movie, which is called The Safe Place.
Yeah.
And Welles was a hero to all these people, because he was the, you know, the very image of the Hollywood maverick who couldn't work within the studio system. And Jaglom was very anxious to get Welles to act in his first movie, and Welles didn't want to do it. Jaglom flew to New York.
It's a great story, by the way.
Convinced him.
Yeah. Well, tell that story, because he basically goes to New York, goes to his hotel, if I recall it right, and he doesn't have – now, this is the crucial point. He doesn't have a script, and Welles does not want to hear about a project if he doesn't have a script. And so as you tell the story in the book, you sort of take it from here, but he basically opens the door. He sees Henry Jaglom, and Orson Welles says, "What do you want?"
Yeah, he was not very welcoming. That's a cinch. You know, yeah. Jaglom was friends with Peter Bogdanovich, who was good friends with Welles by that time. And Bogdanovich warned him, don't even go to Welles if you don't have a script, because the first thing he's going to ask you is where's your script?
Yeah.
But Jaglom was not deterred, flew to New York. I think Welles was staying at the Plaza. Jaglom knocked on his door, and exactly as you described it, Welles said rather brusquely, "What do you want?" And, you know, Jaglom said something, "Well, I think Peter Bogdanovich may have mentioned my name to you." And Welles said, "Well, he's mentioned a lot of names to me. What is that, you know, what's the big deal?"
Right.
And then, you know, they go through the script thing. It turns out that Jaglom didn't have a script, but he had a good reason for it, because he said if Welles accepted the role, his part would be different than if Jaglom were writing it for somebody else. And that made sense. And Welles goes on to say he doesn't do films with first-time directors.
Yeah.
And Jaglom says, "What do you mean? You were a first-time director yourself when you did Citizen Kane." So, you know, Jaglom had a bit of that Welles, you know, resourcefulness and glibness, that he was able to talk people into things they didn't want to do. And eventually, and Jaglom knew enough about Welles to interest him. Welles was an amateur magician, Jaglom says, I want you to play a magician. Wells says, can I wear a cape? Jaglom says, yes, you can wear a cape, et cetera, et cetera. Wells finally agreed, and they became fast, not fast friends from there, but they became friends.
Yeah.
And Jaglom was able to, when Jaglom subsequently ran into him, you know, in 1978, they started having lunch regularly. Jaglom did become Wells, I guess, most prominent supporter and helped him find money in Europe because Jaglom had been making his own films and had been raising money in Europe by selling off foreign territories, which is the method now used by independent filmmakers. And Jaglom was a bit of a pioneer in this respect, and he tried to do that with Wells, unfortunately, without too much success.
Yeah. Well, what was their connection? Because, I mean, they, as you said, they came from, you know, they had different personalities, they had different backgrounds, different ages, of course. But there was something about them that connected. Wells really liked him, and there was something about it that about Jaglom he seemed to trust.
Well, Jaglom is bright, yeah. You know, and he could engage Wells almost on his own level. And close enough,
and,
you know, to keep Wells interested. And he also genuinely admired Wells. There was a bit of the fan in Jaglom. So, you know, some of the parts of the book and the interchanges read like, you know, a fan addressing his idol.
Right.
And Jaglom definitely enjoyed being the gatekeeper to Wells. If you wanted Wells to act in your movie, you had to go through Jaglom. Jaglom acted as a sort of informal agent or manager. He enjoyed basking in the reflected glow that Wells, emanated from Wells. For Wells's part, Jaglom was actually did seriously try to raise money for him, yeah. and involved himself deeply in Wells's life, in the business part of it and in the personal part of it, and became somebody that Wells could, you know, unload to, you know, and be, you know, and discuss things with that, you know, in some sense, some level, he didn't have to be Orson Welles, quote unquote, with.
Yeah.
And you started this conversation by saying, did Wells ever reveal himself in the course of these conversations, and I think there are one or two instances where he does, and they come as sort of a shock because so much of it is Wells being Wells.
Peter Biskind is with us. His book is called My Lunches with Orson, Conversations Between Henry Jaglom and Orson Welles. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the film historian Peter Biskind. He is a film historian, a contributing editor to Vanity Fair magazine. He's the author of 6 books, among them Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, and Down and Dirty Pictures. He edited the new book, My Lunches with Orson, Conversations Between Henry Jaglom and Orson Welles, and he's joining us from Albany, New York. Well, let's talk about the setting for these lunches. They all start, as you say, in 1978. This was at the restaurant Maison, the famous French restaurant in West Hollywood. I get a sense that for Orson Welles, in some ways, he sort of, when he was at his table, he kind of held court in some way. You talk about how people would stop by for as you put it, a golden word or two.
Well, he absolutely did hold court. Ma Maison was a very, very hot in restaurant in those days, and it was so chic that it didn't publish its phone number. So you had to really be an insider to get into the restaurant. Nevertheless, a lot of people seemed to have the phone number because it was always crowded, and right. it was a gathering place for the cream of Hollywood. And Orson had his table, mm-hmm. and it was hard to miss him. You know, he used to, I described as, he was quite heavy and he had his dog with him, and he was attired in these, I guess enormous black, almost like, I don't know how to describe it.
Like a caftan blanket, or something. Yeah.
Caftan,
yeah.
Blanket, I don't know. Layers of black would cover him, and he would sit there, and he had a booming voice, which he was known for. And people would come to his tables. I mean, some of the more amusing parts of this book are the accounts, because the tape recorder was always on. So when somebody came up to the table, he or she would get recorded.
Right.
So there's Richard Burton, who comes up, and Wells, he says, Elizabeth would like to meet you, meaning Elizabeth Taylor. And she's sitting at a table, three tables away. And Wells says, "Can't you see we're eating?" Yeah. And he's very rude and brusque, and Burton slinks back to his table. And meanwhile, Jaglom is kicking Wells under their table, and chastising him for being so rude to Burton. And Wells says, "Well, Burton wasted his talent. He was a great actor, and then he married a celebrity, Arm Candy, and sold out, and now just takes parts for money, and essentially had nothing but contempt for him." There's another funny little incident where Vincente Minnelli's wife comes up to the table, and Minnelli had been sick and in the hospital, and she says, Vincente would be, delighted if you would visit him. He's just got out of the hospital. He misses you, treasures your friendship. And she goes on and on in this vein. When can we do it? Can I have your phone number, et cetera, et cetera? And after she leaves the table, Wells tells Jaglom that he never met Minnelli, and it was a very Hollywood moment.
It's funny because Orson Welles says that he confesses to Jaglom, and in this particular experience with Richard Burton, and this is great. Henry's chiding him at these different moments, for sounding like a bigot or for being rude to Richard Burton or whatever. And he says, Welles tells him he was intent on not being seen as a dancing bear. He could be really particular about that.
Well, he was very, very aware, as you mentioned, of his reputation of, being Orson Welles and, being bigger than life. And he had a reputation for not suffering fools and for being brusque. Every once in a while he felt that he had to act up to it. That's what people expected, and he was, above and beyond anything else, he was an entertainer, and he was giving people what they expected and what he thought they wanted.
Yeah. I want to play a piece of tape. Sadly, we don't have excerpts from the actual conversations themselves. You've talked about how they're really hard to listen to, and the person who transcribed them deserves a medal or something like that because they're really hard to get. But we do, of course, have recordings of Orson Welles engaging with certain people. I want to play a particular tape from – these are some outtakes from a recording session he did for these commercials with this British television Frozen Pea Company, which gives you a sense, I think, of how exacting the man could be. I want people to be able to hear his voice in this conversation as well. I don't know if you've heard these, actually, Peter Biskind, when he's being very particular about the the language in the copy he's reading for this commercial for these frozen peas. I don't know if you've
I haven't heard them, and I have heard the conversation where he's drunk giving the wine commercial.
Yeah, no, that's another one. There are these classic moments of Orson Welles. Well, this is another one from 1970. This is Orson Welles recorded in a radio studio. Again, he's doing a commercial for frozen peas.
We know a remote farm in Lincolnshire where Mrs. Buckley lives. Every July, peas grow there. We aren't even in the fields, you see.
Yeah, we
are. We're talking about them growing, and she's picked them.
Yeah.
What?
In July. Can you emphasize a bit in July?
Why? That doesn't make any sense. Sorry. There's no known way of saying an English sentence in which you begin a sentence with in and emphasize it. Get me a jury and show me how you can say in July, and I'll go down on you. That's just idiotic, if you'll forgive me by saying so. That's just stupid. In July. I'd love to know how you emphasize in and in July. Impossible. Meaningless.
I think all they were thinking about was that they didn't want to...
He isn't thinking.
Wilson, can we just do one last...
Yeah?
And it was my fault. I said in July. If you can leave every July...
You didn't say it. He said it. Your friend. Every July? No, you don't really mean every July. But that's bad copy. It's in July. Of course it's every July. It's too much directing around here.
The great Orson Welles. Wouldn't that be terrifying?
Yes, it was scary to hear it. It's funny, though. I mean, if it's not happening to you, if he's not talking to you, yeah. It's just funny. But what reminded me of is that, you know, we were talking in the last segment about... the true moments where the mask drops for a second.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is a conversation towards the end of the book where he's talking about the fact that he can't get any commercial work anymore. You know, at the end of his career, he lived off his commercials and he was making, I don't know, he said it one year he made $1 million,
right,
essentially off commercials. And then it all dried up. And he's going on and on about John Houseman and how Houseman's, who also was doing commercials, he was thriving. Why couldn't Welles get the commercials that Houseman was getting? But when you hear an excerpt like that, you understand why.
Right.
Because he was a real pain in the ass.
Yeah.
You know? And you know, he talks about one company that found someone who sounded like him and then dropped him. And you can understand why, you know, he didn't like to, he wasn't all that happy about being directed, and certainly not by people whose job it was to direct pea commercials, you know.
Yeah.
If you were Orson Welles, look, he was often the smartest guy in the room.
Right.
And if you're the smartest guy in the room, you know, you act often in an arrogant, you know, it's human nature, an arrogant way, and you put them down in the way he was doing. I mean, he was just skewering them.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about some of the revelations in the, I mean, there's the funny stuff, the provocative stuff, but then you get these moments that are so revealing about, you know, the old studio system. And there's one particular section in, when Orson Welles is being incredibly helpful to Henry, who is trying to get this film written and directed, and you get a kind of narrative sensibility about Orson Welles, how good he was about, you know, just really basic practical kind of advice, and you get a sense of the fact that this wasn't just bluster. He really did know what he was talking about.
Well, that's a great, you know, it's a great section, you know, and I debated a little bit about putting it in because, you know, some people haven't seen the movie they're talking about, but you asked earlier about the nature of their relationship, and one of the things that this reminded me of that I forgot to say was that Jaglom was a working filmmaker, and I think to some degree Welles enjoyed working vicariously through Jaglom since he wasn't able to work himself.
Yeah.
And Jaglom was constantly asking him for advice and help, but you know, Welles came into the editing room and looked at the various cuts while Jaglom was cutting. And this was a case in which he was asking Welles advice on the script before the film was shot. And Welles, right off the top of his head, gives incredibly sort of sensitive advice, is really listening to what Jaglom's saying and responding to it and being extraordinarily helpful, as you say.
There's a moment I wanted to mention a moment early on in a conversation in the book anyway, where Henry, they're talking about actors. They're talking about you know, whether actors are, should be intelligent or if they shouldn't, because as Henry says, people say Brando isn't very bright. And Wells says, well, most great actors aren't. Larry, referring to Laurence Olivier, is very, I mean, seriously stupid. I believe that intelligence, he says, is a handicap in an actor because it means you're not naturally emotive, but rather cerebral. He says the cerebral fellow can be a great actor, but it's harder. I mean, that's a really interesting kind of – now, whether it's true or not, or whether you can prove it or find evidence for it, I mean, this is a kind of a reflection about the art of acting from the great Orson Welles. It's really fascinating.
Well, you know, he thinks – you know, I said earlier that he was a very original – he had a very original mind, but I also – it's also true that he thinks deeply about things.
Yeah.
So, you know, he'll have opinions about things that you never – that – I certainly didn't have any opinions about, or especially, you know, things, I mean, certainly I'm not an actor, but even in areas that I do know something about, I mean, he would go 1, 2, 10 steps farther than normal. He had a very inquisitive mind, you know, and, you know, he says in that same conversation that singers are the stupidest performers. So all they think about is their vocal cords.
Yeah, their throats, yes.
Again, true or not, it's a funny thing to say. But I also want to, before we run out of time altogether, I do want to, I mean, one of the things that I found interesting in the conversations was his reflections on World War II and the French Resistance, and that he changed his mind about Nazi collaborators,
yeah,
which
really
I thought was a very brave thing to do. And interesting, you know, because, you know, after the war, of course, you know, anybody collaborated with the Nazis, especially in France, you know, faced the guillotine, so to speak. And, you know, people like entertainers, especially people like, Maurice Chevalier, there was a shadow over them. And Wells talks about the fact that after the war, he met some of these people, and he went spent a weekend in the country, I think at Olivier's country house,
yeah.
with Oswald Mosley, who was the head of the British fascists. And he didn't know the man that he became friendly with was Mosley. He didn't know his name, and he found out later, and he quite liked him. And he decided that his sort of blanket condemnation of collaborators wasn't fair, and that there were degrees of collaboration. And of course, he said, of course, people who sent the Jews to the camps, you know, were unforgivable. But people like Chevalier, or you know, didn't really have a choice, in his opinion. And who was he to say whose life was not on the line, but who was just protecting his swimming pool in Hollywood? Who was he to condemn them? And it's a very interesting conversation. It's a bit more nuanced than I'm rendering it here, but I found it fascinating.
Yeah. Peter Biskin is with us. His book is called My Lunches with Orson, Conversations Between Henry Jaglom and Orson Welles. And we need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Peter Biskind. We're talking about his book, My Lunches with Orson, Conversations Between Henry Jaglom and Orson Welles. I want to play another piece of tape. This is from a conversation that Orson Welles has on the Dick Cavett Show. This is in 1971. And he's talking about Harry Cohn. And we get references to this and this particular era, the old studio heads, the old moguls, in these conversations with Henry Jaglom. Cohn was the president and the production director of Columbia Pictures, known for being this intimidating and autocratic fellow. And I like this because I'm imagining that this in some way may have been what it was like with Henry Jaglom and Orson Welles, what to hear Orson sort of holding forth. Here it is, Orson Welles on The Dick Cavett Show.
Yeah, he is one of the most interesting characters in film, because No one ever apologizes for saying a rotten thing about a man who is dead, because they always refer to him as the unlamented Harry Cohn.
Well, I lament him.
Do you?
Yeah. I liked him. I really did, because he was a monster.
Yeah.
But they all were, or almost all of them, those guys who ran their own stores in those old days of Hollywood. But he came on as a monster, and he could never be as bad as his first impression. So everything was a pleasant surprise after that. You know, he snarled at you as you came in the door, you know, like that. Yeah. And you could gradually throw him little goodies, and he would quiet down and start lashing his tail.
That's a great clip.
It's a great clip. And you just get a sense of what it must have been like to have listened to Orson Welles hold forth. I wanted to ask you about the way the conversations sort of, I don't know, they kind of, as we head towards 1985, things start to thin out in some ways. Do you get a sense that Orson Welles is sort of, you know, preparing himself for his death?
I don't know that. I think that's overstating it a little bit. I think that it definitely gets darker as you get into 85, because I think, for one thing, he realizes that a lot of these balls that he has in the air are not going to land anywhere, you know, or they're going to land on the ground. You know, he's not going to be able to make King Lear, which was, you know, his fondest wish to play Lear. And I think thought, you know, he was going to be the crowning glory of his career, and that was not going to happen. And a lot of the other projects that he had, you know, pending, were not going to happen. At the same time, he needed money. He desperately needed money, and that's another one of the instances where I think the true Welles breaks through, because he just gives a very moving desperate plea to Jaglom to find him something that's going to make him some money, because he was, you know, he was paying child support.
Yeah.
He had a lot of obligations. He'd been married 3 times, you know, and his income had dried up, because partly because nobody was giving him commercial work. He wasn't getting any film work. He was getting older, and, you know, his knees were bothering him. He had various physical ailments. He was on, you know, his doctor had restricted his diet. So I guess maybe in a way he was getting ready to die, but or for the end. But at the same time, he was vital, you know, and he was forever optimistic about getting something made. I mean, he died with a typewriter on his lap in the middle of the night, writing a script, and he was a great screenwriter too, among his other talents. So, yes, I mean, to some degree, I edited the book that way, because that's what happened. He did die, and you know, and it was true. And what was true is, as time went on, it was clear, became increasingly clear that, you know, his hopes were not going to be realized.
Yeah, but this is an important point, I think, that Welles makes in the way you edited it, the book. That this was not an indolent man. Maybe it was a man who had a lot of things up in the air, projects that he couldn't finish, but not because he was lazy or that he somehow lacked the courage. But and this was something that Henry Jaglom provided, as you mentioned in the book too. He needed someone to help him focus in some way. But as you said, he died with a typewriter on his lap. He wasn't a lazy man.
He wasn't lazy at all. And in fact, I mean, I think if you're as gifted as Welles was, it gets confusing. You know, those of us like myself who can only do one thing, life is much clearer.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to, am I going to be an actor? Am I going to be a movie director? Am I going to be a theater director? Am I going to do, if television, you know, am I going to, if cable television had existed now, he'd be doing a 10-part series for HBO.
Yeah.
Am I going to be a writer? He could draw. I mean, you know, so... He was torn in a lot of different directions, and he was so good at so many things that I think he, you know, he just dissipated his energies.
Yeah. You know, he says that he talks toward the end. There's a section in the book where he says, "Now when my career is only a memory, I'm still sitting here like some kind of monument. But the moment will come," he says, "when I drop out of sight altogether, as though a trap door had opened. And there's this interesting exchange at one of those last lunches where Wells tells Henry that he doesn't want to just fade away in some ways. He prefers what he explains is the Verdi ending, where Verdi had a resurgence in the last years of his life, and he wants to be like that.
Yes, he did. He was very aware that of the transiency of reputation and of fame and the changing fortunes of well-known writers and directors, and how somebody's famous for nobody remembered F. Scott Fitzgerald. Yeah. Nobody remembered Faulkner, and he was afraid it was going to happen to him. I think the interesting thing is that it hasn't.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Well, I wanted to say this finally. I'd referenced the word shy, which sort of surprised you, but it did come from you early on in the book where you were talking about how he was this bundle of contradictions and at once belligerent and childishly vulnerable on one side, a schemer, and as you put it, a shy man who hid behind an endless array of masks. And I want to go there finally because this is how Henry Jaglom thought about it too, that he had all of these kinds of masks. And you say in the book you weren't trying to get at the real Wells. That probably was impossible, but I guess it does give us a fuller picture of a man who did have a lot of masks, the book, ultimately.
Well, yes, I mean, you certainly get that feeling, I don't know that Jaglom ever penetrated the masks. Yeah. I think he feels it. The last film that Wells was in was Jaglom's, was a film of Jaglom's, and Jaglom asked him to not to use any makeup and not to use a false nose, which he always did because he was sensitive that his nose was too small.
Yeah.
And he couldn't do it. He brought, he appeared on the set with his a little box where he had all his makeup on, and he just could not present himself as the unadorned Orson Welles. It was not in him to do that.
Yeah. Peter Biskind, film historian, contributing editor to Vanity Fair magazine. He's the author of 6 books, among them Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, and Down and Dirty Pictures. And, of course, he edited this new book, My Lunches with Orson, Conversations Between Henry Jaglom and Orson Welles. Joined us today from member station WAMC in Albany, New York. And, Peter Biskind, thank you very much for the time.
Well, thank you very much for asking me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Ferguson.